Norm.
Oh! Oh! Shit! You can't do that. You can't sneak up on somebody like that. I almost had a heart attack.
I didn't sneak up on you. I gently tapped you on the shoulder and lightly said, Norm.
Well, you know where it was coming from, like a ghost.
Can I just sit down?
Yeah.
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 612 for the week of April 27th, 2026. I am George Clooney's framed photo of his good friend Richard Kind, Dave D. Cole, and I'm here with terrible interview Sarah D. Bunting.
And I'm cleaning you out of Sun Chips.
Unappreciated halftime dancer Tara Ariano.
You better not be planning a pizza party.
And Kiki Palmer stand Crystal Farmer.
She is extremely likable.
Welcome to Extra Hot Great for another week. Before we get into this episode, it is the end of the month. We want to remind you about the Extra Hot Great Club, which you can join for just $5 a month or $4 a month if you subscribe for the whole year. This gets you a lot of perks if you go through Patreon. You get ad-free episodes. You get discounts on merch at throughmethods.com. And Dave has been on a tear adding new shirts to the store lately. Mm-hmm. I am currently wearing All Right Fred, the exploding whale shirt. There's also No Free Rides, New Jersey Charm School, inspired by a recently discussed episode of Dawson's Creek, and more. You get access to our Discord server where you can not only talk to other listeners, but also get opportunities to participate in the main show. We have a listener game time special coming up in a couple of weeks, and those players are all members on our Discord server. But the biggest perk is probably our Friday bonus episodes, which are all new every week. No reruns ever. If you're wondering why we didn't talk about shows like The American Gladiators Revival, The Miniature Wife, Jury Duty Company Retreat, DTF St. Louis, or the new season of Scrubs, we did. They were all topics on Extra Extra Hot Great, the Friday show. And as we've said, it continues being true. The revenue we get from ads you hear is negligible. And also, we could probably make more if we accepted spots from advertisers like online gambling platforms or fake therapy with an AI chatbot or the Department of Homeland Security, but we don't. Independent media is hard to make and hard to monetize. We cannot make this show without our paid subscribers, so we really try to make it worth your while to join. And the more subscribers we add, the bigger that Friday show gets. So if you can afford it, join the club. Get gift subscriptions for your TV-loving friends. Tell them there's a Drunk Dave episode coming up. That's an inducement.
Yes. Way to bury the lead there.
Raise your pledge if you can. Some of us got laid off from Cracked in September. Not going to say who. There is even more news also about the club, Dave.
Yeah, just a quick note that once in a while I've been saying, you know, if you're on the Discord, put your answers to Ask ESG, which is a segment in the Friday show there, or you can email me. What I've done now is actually put it right on the website. So if you go to our website, you can log in with your Patreon. You sort of click a button that says, do you want to connect these guys? And you're like, yeah. And then you actually can click on a thing in the rundown where it says Ask ESG, and a form will be there where you can type in your answer and then it'll go to me. So you don't have to be on the Discord to answer those questions and be eligible to win those sticker packs. So have at it.
Yes. ExtraHotGreat.com/club for more information on all of this. And now, thank you for your patience. Our episode. Our guest this week is a basketball sicko you have heard with us many times before. It's Crystal Farmer.
Welcome back.
Crystal.
A sicko.
Thank you. It's a whole thing, Dave.
Complimentary.
Okay.
It's a positive.
Crystal is back because we are, of course, talking about season 2 of Running Point, Netflix's sitcom about a Los Angeles basketball team that is not the Lakers. Season 1 ended on a cliffhanger. After shepherding the Waves to the ABL Finals, only for them to suffer a heartbreaking loss, interim president Isla, Kate Hudson, returned to her office to find her brother Cam, Justin Theroux, out of rehab for substance abuse and in her office chair. Season 2 picks up where we left off. Cam wants to come back, but he isn't interested in deposing Isla from her position, really! After Isla has agreed to bring him on as a consultant, there are fires to put out. She needs to hire a coach to replace Jay Ellis, get her chief of staff, Allie, Brenda Song, a long overdue raise, plan her wedding to Lev, Max Greenfield, with whom she has reconciled, figure out a better deal for Dyson, Uche Agata, the farm league player she scouted. It's always something, so it's nice that Cam actually turns out to be very helpful. Surely he doesn't have any ulterior motives he's hiding, right? He might. The show is co-created by Ike Barinholtz, Mindy Kaling, Elaine Coe, and David Stassen. All 10 episodes of Season 2 dropped on Netflix April 23rd. We may talk about events from any of them. Let's do the Chen check-in. Crystal, should our listeners watch Running Point Season 2?
Yes, they should.
Sarah?
Yes, they should.
Dave?
Yep.
I agree. We watched all 10 episodes in a row in a sitting on Sunday, and it was a good time. Let's get into it. Crystal, let's say you're a president of a basketball team. Your coach options are Danny from OU, played by Adam DeMarco, and Norm from Disgrace in Detroit, played by Ray Romano. If you're Isla, based on the information ahead of you, in front of you, rather, are you hiring Norm as she is?
Probably not. I mean, he's great. Obviously, we love Ray Romano. He's so fun. But, you know, if you're trying to win games, you don't necessarily hire the guy who, like you said, left his last job in disgrace. But I understand why she does it, right? I think if she were to hire the OU guy, he has a lot of ideas that are very likely going to put Isla out of a job and probably a lot of those players, you know, off the team, which is something she's trying to avoid. So were I her, I probably would, if I wanted to win games, go with the OU guy. But if I wanted to keep my job, I'd choose Norm. He's just a good time. I like him a lot.
Or when Cam was so enamored with the UO coach, who was basically coded as a tech bro in the conference suite, that, you know, that wasn't going to happen. So it's just a question of who's going to be the corn-fed, homegrown sort of guy that was going to replace him. And I forgot that Ray Romano was cast in this. So when he came up, I'm like, oh, that's perfect. And I cannot stand Everybody Loves Raymond, but I quite enjoy Ray Romano in this. And if you hired him, you know, he would say, Crystal!
That would be great. I'd love that. Yeah, I'm not an Everybody Loves Raymond person either, but I do like him when he pops up in anything else, like Men of a Certain Age. And that show from a couple of years ago was Kristen Milioti, Billy Magnuson.
Oh, Made for Love. Yes. Yeah. We just brought that up with when we were talking about The Audacity.
Played her father. Yeah.
Sarah, as our resident college basketball sicko, what were your thoughts on the coaching decision?
As a, you know, a rooter for a team that has recently gone through this process, and, you know, like, you're a fan, so your job is to, like, listen to sports radio and either nod or fume, depending on who's talking. But this is, I think, this show's particular gift, is that it's, like, basketball-y enough for basketball sickos, but it also understands that, like, this tension between, do you hire the whatever Gen X or boomer coach who, like, is part of the team family, so to say, and has, you know, like, vibes versus algorithm, like Claude picking your lineup. So I think that it understands that these are tensions that are in every sport and every, like, workplace, like, in every aspect of life. And it, like, can mine that narrative tension, but you don't need to know that much about basketball to enjoy it, because these are just, like, stories about groups of humans that don't all agree about how things should go. So I think that's the show's gift. But Carolina just let go a coach who was a, you know, member of the Carolina family. Like, I could give you 12 paragraphs on that easily. I won't. You're welcome. But this process and, like, the things that it brings out in people, which are, like, literally never good, I think the show understands how to make that funny and understands that it's a workplace comedy that, that, you know, it's basketball-y enough. They're not making mistakes or anything, as far as I know, but it's also like, okay, these are tensions everybody is dealing with in various parts of their lives, and here's how we're going to make that universal, is by making it very specific to this imaginary basketball team.
Mm-hmm. Before we move off the coaches, Norm at the Pete's Coffee by his condo with a full desktop computer set up and a bathroom key attached to a whisk because he's there every day was a very funny character detail.
Yeah.
But also a reminder, Ray Romano was a recast. Originally, the new Waves coach was going to be played by Robert Townsend. And I guess they, like, you know, reconceived the character. And so they had to recast. But I would love to know, like, what the brief was for him. If, for people who don't know, Robert Townsend was, like, most recently seen playing Sidney's father in The Bear. So it's a very, very different kind of a guy.
Yeah. Especially since he's styled with this Al Pacino in Any Given Sunday. Like, cast to him. Maybe it's just the hair that is like a completely different vibe performance. But then you also have Cameron Diaz as the brittle blonde ownership representative that, I don't know, interesting parallel.
Yeah.
There. But yeah, that's a whole different show.
Yeah, he's got some Eddie Bauer schlub.
The show lays the groundwork early for events in the middle of the season with Isla's many sexy fantasies about Jay. But even if they had not, Dave, do we agree Lev and Isla had no business getting back together? This I've discovered from our Discord thread, is something you feel passionate about.
It was more that I just don't understand how this character, this workaholic character, is not like a super great person, can like net three suitors in the course of, I don't know what that was, 4 months, 3 months that we had in this second season. Like, I think Lev dodged a bullet.
Yes. That's what I was getting at.
So, okay. I don't get that part of it. I mean, I suppose it's the Mindy Kaling of it all. Like, everything is this fantasy version of a 90s rom-com. But that part didn't ring true to me. And also, while we're on the Mindy Kaling of it all, do you suppose her personal assistant has health insurance? Because I kind of wonder. I kind of think that maybe there's a chance she doesn't. Because that's the storyline here in the second season, a big one at the second half, that the cheerleader squad of the Waves just basically are getting like minimum wage or tips or whatever less. The hell it works.
Yeah.
And, you know, they go on strike and they're demanding healthcare and all that kind of stuff. And then in a surprising scene in the conference room where the CEO board's all talking about it with Allie, who I thought would be the one person in that group. She's not a CEO, but she's like the PA to Isla. Like, everybody's like, oh, fuck those guys. How dare they want more money and healthcare? And what can we give them? And like, the first thought is, well, we can't give them pizza. And then like, there's like this, that was the plan all along, to give them pizza. So that part of it was kind of surprising. And it just kind of feels like it was there. We needed a measure and wish to humanize the president of the Waves. And I just didn't really buy that whole storyline, both the way it bubbled up, but also the reaction to it, which is, yeah, we'll do all those things you asked for, instead of we'll find 30 more people to be our cheerleader squad, which would probably be the case.
Well, that's, yeah, that's initially the plan. But there are a lot of episodes that sort of the premise of starts with, we have to do this thing and we don't have enough money. And then by the end of the episode, it's like, well, we figured it out. Question mark. Like, we can't give Dyson a raise. We can't give Allie a raise. We can't, you know, give the dancers what they deserve. And then, like, all of it just gets figured out. So
they keep saying, like, that this franchise, the Waves franchise, you know, it's like a family business. Like, a lot of the other franchises are owned by people who made money in tech or oil or what have you. And that this one, they bought it when it was really cheap, and it has become very profitable over the decades. And like, oh, we just don't have the money because it's a family business. But like, that's kind of not really true. Like, one of the things that Isla or Allie keeps saying, or, you know, sometimes sitcoms will do this where they're like, we need two people to have a conflict. So we're going to create a conflict where one of the people is like very clearly in the right and the other one is very clearly in the wrong, but we're going to craft the story such that it seems like both sides have issues they need to overcome. And it's like, Isla, if you're Allie's best friend and you are the billionaire owner of a sports franchise, like, and she's like, hey, can I get a raise? You probably should say yes if that's your best friend, you know. You don't have a right to get upset with her when you say no and she makes a choice that is better for her family financially. Again, like you're saying, Tara, they work it out, right? Like, they get to a point where they're like, okay, yes, we can do this and we're gonna do it, and now everyone's a family again. We're all back together again. Which is, you know, that's how sitcoms
but all that happens in the backdrop of like signing superstar players that happen to become, you know, free agents, and they're giving them, they're like, we need $150 million and but we can't find $120,000 for healthcare benefits for like 10 people or whatever it is.
Yeah.
So like there's a lot of that. And there's a lot of just so like shushing it away under the carpet. They don't really go into depth on all of this. So they kind of want to have their cake and eat it too with some of these issues that they bring up.
Well, but then it's not going to be funny. Then it's like watching how the Pittsburgh Pirates are actually owned and how life is lived in that executive suite, which is not funny or entertaining. So is there a show to be made that's sort of more of a drama, like satire of these ownership groups? Sure, but I don't know if I want to watch something like that and get mad. So some of this sitcom hand waving is necessary, I think, for it to still be a sitcom.
No, I agree. I don't want to watch Money either. That's boring. But there are other ways to create conflict between the characters.
Right. But I mean, why bring it up if you don't want to actually follow through on the storyline?
Right.
That's all. Like, I think it would have been a better call just to not have that storyline in the show.
Totally.
Yeah. But that's the Kaling of it all, like you were saying.
But also, speaking of Allie, like, they sort of kept hinting through the whole season she's having problems with her husband. He wants to change careers. He's taking, like, classes at Flappers. And then she, like, moves to Toronto, and they never say, like, oh, she moves to Toronto and moves back right away. Like, did her husband and child go with her? Like, we never find out. And then by the end of the season, it's just, like, still unresolved. So I don't know why they brought it up. Any of that.
He was a big hit, and they kept him at Second City.
He got Nirvana the band the spot at the Rivoli.
I know it's a comedy. But that portrayal of everything Canadian was so broad and ham-fisted that I actually was sort of insulted by it. And that's not the kind of thing I'm usually insulted by. Mm-hmm. But like, first of all, the guy's doing, I don't know, a voice out of Fargo or something like that.
Yeah.
The whole thing was just lazy. Although I did enjoy the negative traffic filter they put on everything in Canada where it's almost grayscale with the touch of blue. But everything to do with that storyline just was, it just like nails on a chalkboard to me.
And if you want someone to play that part who is tall and sounds Canadian, Adam DeMarco, who played Danny, the guy from OU, is Canadian. He's from Toronto. Like, get him to do it.
Also, they kept bringing up how that guy was, like, super hot. They could have just hired the OU guy. The guy they hired to play the OU guy to play that guy, because he was much, in my opinion, like, more conventionally, like, a hot guy.
Like, it makes Blame Canada look like Oscar-winning screenplay in comparison. Like, he gets a call and he has to, like, go pick up his kid from school because there's been a bear attack or something like that. I'm like, oh, Jesus.
In Toronto.
Yeah, in Toronto. Yeah. Anyways.
Episode 2 introduces Al Fleischman, Toilet King of Orange County. He's played by Ken Marino. He has a big part throughout the season. Aside from Dawson's Creek, I'm basically never mad to see Ken Marino, but what did everyone think of what he did with the character? Let's start with Sarah.
I think this kind of character now is just his wheelhouse, and he can be on autopilot. Not that he was, but it's like once you have hired Ken Marino for this part, then it is Ken Marino'd. So I guess I could have been interested in a different idea of what this character is, but this is what Ken Marino does. And if he's available, just get him. So yeah, I thought it was fine.
Well, and he's worked with Justin Theroux a bunch, and he's also, his wife is a director and writer on the show, so it's probably easy to get him down there.
Yeah. Does anybody want that sequin toilet shirt?
Thank you. I'm going to bring that. I do think you should make a t-shirt with toilet in gothic class text like we see him wear in a
sequin black letter toilet shirt.
Did not hate it.
Crystal?
I think the persona they're trying to trade on is there's a really famous Lakers fan named Jimmy Goldstein. You see him, he has a very specific look. He's like an older white man with very long gray, like, frizzy hair, and he's always wearing black skinny jeans and like a giant hat, like bedazzled hat. He has a whole look. I think he's just there to be seen, Jimmy Goldstein. I don't think he's like trying to get involved in the franchise in any way, but I think they're kind of playing off of those types, that type of character where it's like, they're just like, I'm here to be seen. I want to be in on the celeb of it all, even though like nobody knows that guy. Like he's not Ken Marino, the Toilet King, is not like a famous person, right? Like, yeah. But he wants to be, and that's kind of his whole deal. So yeah, I enjoyed that. Characterization.
This is a very pleasurable Google image search of this guy. Just Google Jimmy Goldstein Lakers. This is someone who looks like he should be in a Softies Brothers movie like any minute now.
That is so, you are so right, Tara. Oh my God. I can't believe they haven't gotten him in. Whenever they do one in LA, they gotta get him in there. Yeah.
So Cam is back. He's also got a sober companion who is not very helpful, played by Blake Anderson from Workaholics. I would love Blake Anderson to cut his hair and see what happens to his career, because he sort of seems like a hairdo with a guy attached more so than an actor. One final note, and then we can move on. Chet Hanks, really a lot less to do this season, possibly because he was stuck in Colombia. That was a story like a month ago. He had a problem with his passport, but I think it was the right call to put him further in the background of the team, especially since anytime he's next to any other player, especially Dyson, he's so wee. Tiny. He's just a little guy.
Tiny man. Yeah.
He's teamy.
Oh, wait, I have a question before we move on. Yes. I didn't watch the whole season, so do we ever actually see John Stamos's gazelle-esque pickleballing play?
Not this season, but, you know,
damn it.
If it gets renewed, I can imagine Stamos. He would be easy to book.
But speaking about the Fast, you get Scott Speedman in this season. Mm-hmm. And I just want to know, does anybody think that the hockey thing was meant to be a potential spinoff series?
Oh,
because it kind of comes in and they already have two suitors. And then Scott Speedman is the third, which seems like one too many. You don't really get the sense that they're like super clicking, where he's the obvious choice between him and Jay. So I'm wondering, maybe this is supposed to be, you know, like, you know, whatever the running point equivalent, you know, right wing, or I don't know, like center ice.
Yeah, I don't know hockey terms, so you guys are going to have to help me, Canadians.
You're asking the wrong people.
Yeah.
Yeah, I could see that, especially with heated rivalry being so hot.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I think like they maybe just lucked into it, you know, it being a hockey thing. And now Netflix is probably like, hey, you know, when you're done with RJ Decker, come over here and let's do this hockey thing. And we need to hire 15 gay guys so the whole team is gay in our show. So it'll be even better.
Yes.
That would be good.
Straight to series order. I'm in.
Yeah.
Newfangled stories on my electric story box.
I like how he said 15 players. Like, I know how many people are in the hockey team.
I don't. I was like, I'm sure that's right.
That sounds right. James Canadian. He must know.
Yeah.
It's time to go around the dial talking about what we've been watching on TV lately. First up, Tara, what do you got?
So earlier this week, I was planning to talk about Half Man in this slot. That's the new show from Richard Gadd, the star and creator of Baby Reindeer. But I watched the first episode, and my review is there's nothing worse than a man who thinks he's interesting. So instead, I'm going to talk about season 15 of Call the Midwife.
How many births could there possibly be in Britain left? Well, they delivered everybody.
They've only gotten to 1972.
Well, that's when they stopped.
They stopped making British people?
They stopped making British people. Yep.
It's 1972. It is a changing world. The DHS is starting to streamline a lot of their processes and providers, including telling Sister Julianne that if the sisters of Nanata's house want to continue their district nurse services, they'll have to stop wearing their habits and switch to standard nurse uniforms. And this is a big crisis because they consider themselves, you know, missionaries in the neighborhood. And so this is a big issue for Sister Julianne to think about. Meanwhile, Sister Monica Joan is starting to show her age for real, including losing interest in sweets. If you can fucking believe it, that's how dire it is.
Oh, no.
Nurse Rosalind and Cyril, the social worker slash pastor, are getting a lot closer, including taking a vacation together, for which Rosalind has prepared by getting on the pill. And Trixie's brother Jeffrey is around more and still fabulous. One of the sweetest storylines is his friendship with Sister Veronica, who is very interested in having a baby of her own. If you're a good person who supports PBS or a less good person who acquires episodes of the show through methods, or if you're neither good nor bad, you're just British, you've been able to watch to the end of the season already. I did that this weekend because I subscribed to PBS. No big deal. definitely feels like a series finale, but officially it isn't. The creative team is pausing the show for a couple of years, and they're going to do a movie and a prequel spinoff, and then it'll probably be at least partially a new cast when it comes back for series 16, whenever that is.
Yes, Telegram Dave. The Midwife, is that the prequel?
It's literally good. Call the midwife, run into the street and yell midwife, yeah. And see what happens.
Open the window and scream, the midwife. Yeah.
Yes. So the franchise is going fallow in one respect, but it's still going strong in others. So you won't have to wait too long for more opportunities to sob your eyes out. But even if this had been the end, it would have been a satisfying way to stop, I feel.
Yes, I don't want to tell them their business, but I think the other sequel should be the other end of it, where it's about the Undertakers. Called The Undertaker.
Interesting.
Yes. Sort of like a British 6 feet Under.
Yeah. I would watch that.
Okay.
For my plugs, Forte, the Los Angeles rescue that we got Gordon from, was robbed this weekend. They, like, basically the vehicle they used to do rescues was robbed, and they stole, like, a lot of basic stuff. So they have urgent fundraising needs to replace tools like leashes and collars and microchip readers and dog food and more. So if you can, we'll put the link in the show notes, but it's farescue.org/donate. They do good work. And if you ever loved a photo of Gordon, you know, give them even $5. They would appreciate it very much and put it to great use. And for my other plug, I mentioned it last week, but it actually went up on Friday, my post about the Rockford Files at Defector, and we will link that as well.
All right, Crystal, what do you got for us? And it better not be about basketball.
Oh, no.
Oh, shit.
Dave, I have bad news. It's about...
This is a basketball podcast, Dave. Come on.
I know. Last week, you guys turned it into a basketball podcast, that's right. Is what I heard. I watched, I think it was last week, the documentary Jerry West, The Logo, on Amazon Prime. If you are an NBA fan, you know that name. If you are not, I'll just describe who he is. He's one of the kind of cornerstones of the early days of basketball becoming like a major sport. He was on the Lakers in the 1960s and sort of is part of the origin of the Lakers-Celtics rivalry. He played at the same time as Bill Russell, who was the Celtics star, and they had like a number of battles in the playoffs, most of which the Lakers lost. If you know anything about Lakers history, that's kind of was their deal for a while, was they could never get over the hump of the Celtics. And then they eventually did in 1972, which is something that kind of colored how people thought of his career while he was still playing. But eventually, after he stopped playing, he had much, much, much more success after becoming, I think he was the coach of the Lakers for a couple of years and then became the GM and was instrumental in building the Lakers into a dynasty, both in the 80s with the Showtime Lakers and then in the 90s and 2000s with Kobe and Shaq. He was the person who drafted Magic Johnson. He was the person who drafted Kobe, convinced Shaq to come to the Lakers. He was just a very successful sort of executive front office person. He had very, very high highs professionally, but was a person to have very like low lows personally. He had a lot of sadness in his life, and we learned a lot about that in the documentary, particularly early in his life. But I think it's a really interesting document to have because all of the interviews took place, I think, in 2023 and 2024, and Jerry West passed away in 2024. And, you know, we don't really have very many of the players from this era left anymore. And so having a lot of him talking on the record about how he feels about all manner of things was really, really interesting and fun and funny and, you know, touching at times and sad at times. But I think it's a really interesting documentary if you're interested in like that period of the NBA and how it got to where it is today.
Nice. Do you have anything you want to plug?
To keep it basketball related, I would just like to plug the WNBA. The new season is about to start on May 8th, and it's a really fun time to jump in if you're interested, but you're like, I'm not really that interested in what men are doing. You can check in with the WNBA.
And I'm not.
I mean, Tara, you might be perfect for this because this is like the 30th year, and so there's a lot of foo-fura around the 30th anniversary, and there's also two new teams that's their inaugural season this year, the Portland Fire and, for the Canadians, the Toronto Tempo. So if you want to get in on the ground floor of like a new franchise and you don't want to jump on a bandwagon, this is like a really good time. So, yeah, WNBA.
Sarity Bunting.
Speaking of Amazon Prime, I am talking about Killing Grounds, the Gilgo Beach murders, which is a four-parter on Prime Video. It came out last week. The director, Emma Cooper, also directed Depp v. Heard. And I have to think that she watched the Gilgo Beach killer, Rex Hoyerman, lumbering into court earlier this month to give a guilty plea and wondered where that left. Her docuseries, it's clear from some like evolving text cards in the docuseries that, you know, events were unfolding while they were editing. They were able to pivot enough, I think, to stay relevant. But the question with this and with any documentary about this topic is relevant to what? Robert Colker's Lost Girls already exists. Jibby the King by Gus Garcia Roberts already exists and covers a lot of this story and what makes it greater than the sum of the case file, which is centering the victims as though that's the natural thing to do, which I think the culture now thinks it is. That's more the default now, not standing in judgment of sex workers and people who have become involved, enmeshed with substance misuse. This is standard now. Some of these properties talking about these cases 10 years ago, 15 years ago, I think helped that shift along. But now talking about this case, it's like, well, it's either not adjudicated yet, or it is adjudicated and there's nothing else to say. Or in the case of Rex Hoyerman, he took this deal probably so that he could gas on to the behavioral science unit about how clever he was with these monstrous crimes. But for a documentarian, it's like, well, what's the play? And I'm actually not totally sure that it knows where its story is. The early going of Killing Grounds was not promising for me. A lot of reenactments that were on the border of okay taste, in my opinion, using Nancy Grace B-roll, never a thing that I enjoy seeing. Spooky B-roll of Gilgo Beach at twilight. Like, does this have to be four parts? Does this have to be at all? There's some timeline confusion where a woman who was in a lot of talking heads as an interviewee, it turns out she passed away a few years ago. That's not Chiron anywhere. That seems bad. But it grew on me. Like, I wound up watching the whole thing, which, like, I watch these things for a living. Usually you get a sense pretty early on that it's just going to be that, like, here's a teaser for itself at the top of episode two, and you know exactly what you're getting. You could read some of my criticism as, like, is this cynical obfuscation? Is this sloppiness? I don't think so. I think that it is Cooper wanting to leave the voices of families and survivors as entire and forceful as she can. The compelling moments in Killing Grounds had me pausing it to scribble notes about how you don't usually hear comments like that or from these voices. And that's why I stuck with it to the end. They felt authentic and significant. And sometimes I wanted whole episodes or documentaries on those points of view, like the survivor's guilt that other sex workers are and were feeling around this case. An ABC reporter just talking about how she's been on this case from the beginning and it's put, you know, it's put years on her. A co-worker of Hoyerman saying she was a survivor. Why didn't she see what was in him? And it's like, this is how these monsters survive, because they don't let you see. And the victims never stood a chance. And the way that she puts it is really, I don't know, like, you don't want to use the word fresh in this context, but it was like just a little bit different, a couple of degrees to one side of the usual points of view that you get. So I do have some notes about the series. It's not going to be for everyone, but I would say give it a try for an episode. And there's glimmers of the real story in here that make it worth your while, I think. My full review is at bestevidence.fyi, and we'll link that in the show notes.
All right, here's what's coming up in the weeks ahead. We are taking a couple weeks off for some Dirk's birthday. On EHG Primes, we have these for you. 6:13 is going to be an All Canon special. 6:14 is going to be listener game time, which we just recorded, and it was super fun. Mm-hmm. And then we'll be back live in the studio for a 6:15, which is going to be something absolutely amazing that will blow your socks off. You'll be like, holy fuck. Mm-hmm. That's what you're going to be saying. Yeah. And then on EHGs, we're going to have Widow's Bay this Friday, a show that we've already dipped into. And it's so far, I am liking it. Mm-hmm. And then week after that, for 408, we're going to be talking about Legends. And then after that, 409, we'll be dipping into the May Forcening, and that is Blue Mountain State. So go to extrahotgreat.com/club to find out more about joining and what you get. And we will see you then. Goodbye.
Perfect.
Yeah. It is time for the Extra Hot Great Canon presenting this week. It is Julie. Julie, take it away.
Like a sock-clad Burke Cooper singing and dancing to the wistful, the best things in life are free. Season 7, Episode 8 of Mad Men, Waterloo, performs an elegant soft shoe. A satisfying balance of sad, funny, and hopeful, it's an episode of endings and beginnings for characters, marriages, the firm, and the 1960s. If I were nominating this for a tiny canon, the category would be, should have been the series finale. It's July 1969, and the moon landing is imminent. In lesser hands, this historical event becomes an overwrought metaphor. But not on Mad Men, where the reality of a few men floating in a tin can to touch the face of God excites, terrifies, and ultimately galvanizes our characters. Witnessing the greatest technological achievement of the decade via 1960s primitive media is a great and hilarious irony the show has so much fun telling and showing. The clash of old and new technology is, of course, a favorite of the show. Harry, being continually dismissed as a joker, despite being the future with his media buys and computer, represents the terror that can come with the dawn of a new era. This episode ostensibly showcases men who have to overcome their own fears to lead. The astronauts first and foremost, and then Roger, Don, Bert, Ted, and even grouchy Jim Cutler. But not Pete, of course. He's still a stinker. But they all lead out of fear. Not the women. I think the episode is actually toying with the mythology of astronauts' bravery to comment on women's strength. This is referenced a few times. In a brief moment with Sally Draper announcing her physical strength to her hunky house guest, Don's rickrack-wearing secretary Meredith offering to be Don's strength, and Megan demurring when Don offers to take care of her. But it's Peggy Olson who demonstrates it best of all. Peggy contains multitudes. In this scene, she's having work done on her building, and we see her grappling with her own competing and conflicting identities. Who will she be today? The successful career woman, the flirt, or the mother? Clip one.
Hello? Oh, I'm sorry. Where's Casimir?
I had to run downtown.
Oh. Well, it looks like you're doing a good job.
Once you get the grid up, just try not to break the tiles.
I'm Peggy, by the way.
I'm Nick. You got a lot of books.
So hot in here. Would you like some iced tea?
No, Cash will give you a discount. Your son was a big help.
My son? Oh, Julio. No, he's my neighbor. I own the building.
By yourself?
I was very clear. I am not paying before it's finished.
That's my number. In case you have any odd jobs, too small for Kaz.
Oh, thank you. But are you sure that your brain is getting overdone? Good night.
Good night. Good night, kid.
The way she goes from flirty to businesslike to girlish in a matter of seconds is excellent. And in case we forgot that Peggy once had a baby she gave up for adoption, we are reminded of that in the next scene at her Upper West Side townhouse. Clip two.
Can I watch TV?
I'm sorry, you can't. I'm working. Wait, get in here. This is a suit, and it has a skirt, and it has gray in it, which is what men wear. And this is a dress, and it's pretty, but I might be sweating, but not just because it's July. Forget it.
I gotta watch Sunday. That's when they're supposed to land.
I'm sorry, but I'm going to be in Indianapolis.
Why?
Because we're presenting to Burger Chef Monday morning. I know, the astronauts may not make it, and then what are we gonna say? Oh. I'm sorry. They're going to be fine.
It's not fair.
You know what? I'll give you the key and you can come down and watch yourself. Just don't use the stove again.
I don't want to go to Newark.
Nobody does.
My uncle has a house and he got my mom a job. I don't want to leave.
You're moving? That's okay. Maybe you'll have a yard. You want your mom to have a job, don't you?
She don't care about me.
Yes, she does. That's why she's moving.
Family is another resonant theme throughout the series, and Peggy's relationship with her 10-year-old neighbor has a certain early 70s sitcom vibe about it. All those Norman Lear single mothers yet to come. But just as she has made a makeshift family with her neighbor, she has also made one with her coworkers, and we see them together watching the successful moon landing. The next day, in a room where the only other woman present is clearly an assistant, Peggy nails the pitch. She's taken Don's words, twisted them, and made them her own. Clip 3.
But tonight, I'm going to go back to New York, and I'll go back to my apartment and find a 10-year-old boy parked in front of my TV, eating dinner. Now, I don't need to charge you for a research report that tells you that most television sets are not more than 6 feet away from the dinner table. And that dinner table is your battlefield and your prize. This is the home your customers really live in. This is your dinner table. Dad likes Sinatra, son likes the Rolling Stones. The TV's always on. Vietnam playing in the background. The news wins every night. And you're starving. And not just for dinner. What if there was another table where everybody gets what they want when they want it? It's bright and clean, and there's no laundry, no telephone, and no TV. And we can have the connection that we're hungry for. There may be chaos at home. But there's family supper at Burger Chef.
The astronauts land safely, and so do the rest of the characters in this episode. It closes with the delightful song and dance by Bert Cooper, but to me, the fitting symbol of his arc is the looming presence of artist Jackson Pollock's abstract masterpiece One that hangs behind him as he watches TV. Knowing how meticulous Mad Men was about history, I hope to learn the painting was donated to the Museum of Modern Art in July 1969, and that the person who donated it was an advertising executive. Alas, it was not. It came to the museum a year earlier. Jackson Pollock made the painting in 1950, and part of its notoriety was that a photographer was there to capture it all. At first shocking, and then accepted by the vanguard, Pollock and his irreverent black and white drips fueled an artistic movement. But by 1969, the painting had become a museum piece. No longer shockingly new, and eclipsed by the next big thing, minimalism and other art movements on the rise. By then, Bert, too, was a relic. His death, sad as it was his final act of bravery, and the only way for our Mad Men characters to move into the future. And so, to this esteemed panel, I beg you, please vote in Waterloo into the canon.
Thank you, Julie. Crystal, you selected this. Please start us off.
Yeah, so I picked this because Mad Men is my favorite drama of all time. I was obsessed with it when it aired and for the entire run of the series. Not to brag, but I did watch it from the very moment that it aired. I was one of the few people that was like tuned in to AMC. I was like, they have a show? That's weird. But I loved it. But then I feel like people fell off of the show and, you know, it lost some of the power. And I think it was because the show kind of narrowed its focus and you lose some of the characters that I thought were so interesting. And you also lose a lot of the business intrigue, which is part of, I think, the thing that made the show interesting in the first place. Is like, I assume there are other shows about advertising that have existed before Mad Men, but this one felt very realistic and, what is the word you guys always use? Processy. It felt very processy. You know, you're really getting into the details of how it actually worked in the 60s when this show was set. But then also, I think people fell off because the show, like, narrowed its focus to Dawn. I think Dawn is, like, fundamentally an unknowable character and probably isn't going to change very much. So to spend two seasons watching him kind of, like, crash out was really not that satisfying, because we know at the end of the day, he's probably going to do the same things he's always been doing. And one of the things he's going to do is continue to be good at advertising. So we could have just seen that for the other, you know, two seasons if that was going to be the case. But I think this episode is so wonderful because it gets back to all of the things that made the show very good in the early seasons. When I was rewatching it this morning, I realized that it reminded me so much of my favorite episode of the show, which is the season, I think it's 3, finale, Shut the Door, Have a Seat, which is like, it's the best episode in my opinion, because you get everything that makes the show like really good, right? Like you get the focus on Don's like personal life crumbling and his professional life sort of kind of crumbling, but he figures out a way to get it like back on track. All of the characters kind of coming together to sort of do this thing in the Shut the Door, Have a Seat. They're trying to like, it's essentially a heist episode where they're taking all of their clients and staff and starting their own agency. And here it's similar, right? Like they're kind of trying to save the agency in the wake of Cutler, I believe, trying to like jettison Dawn. You know, we get a lot of the kind of fun balancing of tones, right? Some of this episode is like quite sad and quite dark, but then you have a lot of funny kind of moments, like with Peggy and or with Pete or Harry. Like you have a lot. Harry's always obviously the comedic foil for a lot of characters, which I think is really fun. I love Rich Sommer in this role, and you have a lot of the like magical realism kind of filmmaking, right? Which they do in Shut the Door, Have a Seat with Don's flashbacks to his childhood, and here you get it with the Bert Cooper soft shoe at the end and his farewell, which was really more devastating than I remember. Like I watched this episode and I was like, why am I crying? Like I've seen this episode like 10 times, but it was really wonderful. And obviously the sort of centerpiece is the Peggy Burger Chef pitch, which, you know, you get some of that in the Shut the Door, Have a Seat of Peggy coming into her own and being like, I'm not just your pet Dawn. Like I'm my own person with my own like direction that I want to go in. And it's not always the direction you're going in, right? And here we see her kind of like slide right into that Dawn role, you know, at Dawn's insistence, sort of being like, they're going to like ship me off. And if they do, we're going to lose this business. So you take it. And she does. And she does such a good job. I'm watching Peggy like give the Burger Chef pitch and I'm like fist pumping. And I'm like, all she's doing is standing there talking. And it's like silent and everyone's watching her. But I'm like, a show that can turn that moment into like a fist pumping like climax is like an amazing show. But like, yeah, I just think this episode is really great. And it to me is up there with the best episodes of the show from the first half. Reminds us that it could still do those things, even though it was choosing to sort of go in a different direction. So yeah, I really love this episode. And I'm interested to hear what you all have to say about it.
Well, Sarah, no one wants to go to Newark, but why don't you go next?
Just that nobody does was so good. Oh, poor Newark. I had not seen this episode in a while. I think probably not since it aired. Should have been the series finale would be an excellent tiny canon placement for this, I guess, if that were possible to do, or like an alterna canon, because the late great Robert Morris doing his like literal soft shoe, like I think he just had socks on, as Bert tended to do in the office. And then the occasional cut back to Dawn watching him and the inscrutable, but also somewhat knowable sometimes way, like his eyes are filling up and he's bereft, but also filled with wonderment at this dancing apparition played by a man who played Truman Capote on Broadway. I think he won awards for that performance, Robert Morris. So I've always loved that moment and I loved that the show did it because it was very true to the character. Overall, I would say that this episode is good at doing what the show, like Crystal said, was good at in earlier seasons before it just started kind of picking at the scab of Don's alcoholic narcissism. And not that the performance wasn't good and not that it wasn't compelling in its way, but the show sometimes seemed to struggle with how to signal to the viewer that it understood that Don was a difficult person to know. Not just hard to know what he's thinking, but just like hard to be around a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. And not have it feel like characters were sort of like Mario suing or sort of being an audience voice. Cutler was excellent writing and casting for that purpose, but it didn't feel too contrived. The moment also at the end of this, or in the middle of this episode, where the marriage to Megan, just like the last gossamer threads holding it to itself, they both hear them snap mm-hmm. on this phone call. I thought Megan was a sort of better and more useful character and a good portrayal than I think a lot of people. But I was also fully on the let's unpack every season 7 episode for evidence of D.B. Cooper train. So the fuck do I know? But I thought that was really wonderfully observed and not overplayed. I think all the elements of different families and how they assemble and reassemble were really lightly and beautifully done. And I think other episodes in these last 2 seasons would have made much more of the paternal role that Bert played for Don. This one didn't overplay it. There was a lot of humor, but also just a lot of rue, you know, not hammering it too hard, but just a lot of like regret, a little bittersweetness. And the show at this point was not always very good at balancing that, especially since I think everybody knew that this was the home stretch for mm-hmm. it. So it was nice to revisit this, and it was nice to just like have Harry be the very reliable butt of jokes. And he's like, I'll take the deal. Goodbye, Harry. And he just storms out in his plaid pants. And Pete is being a pill, but not too annoying. I mean, it really was like a perfectly balanced episode that this late in the run was a little more uncommon and unexpected. So it was a delight, even though Jersey caught some strays. That's just life. Tara.
Yeah, I agree with Julie and Sarah that this should have been the series finale, not just because of where it leaves everyone, but because the show started just before the presidential campaign of 1960, and then ending, you know, if you started there, sort of this real start of the 60s with Kennedy, and then end on the moon landing, that sort of feels like, okay, that's the end of the 60s, mm-hmm. unless you're going to do an episode on Altamont, that's a wrap. Really. Yeah. But I thought Julie made a beautiful argument, and I agree with so much of what both of you have already said. There's so much to see in this episode. There's so much of all of the characters still, like Roger reminding everyone that he is not completely useless, like he hasn't just totally checked out. He does have a function at the firm, mm-hmm. at the agency, and this is it. It's like to sort of save it in the 11th hour, and that he seems to know maybe more than anyone else that he's on his way out. Like this job is not going to be as important now in the era of like, you know, media buys and computers, but this is something he can do now to let Don continue making great ads, and Don's protege also. I wish I could have been there when it occurred to them, the writers of this episode, Carly Rae and Matt Weiner, that the song should be "The Moon Belongs to Everyone, the Best Things in Life Are Free," because it is on the nose. But they do so much with it that's so lovely. Like, yes, the moon belongs to everyone and the best things in life are free, unlike everything, all the bullshit you're trying to sell all the time, like Burger Chef, you know?
Yeah.
Peggy's pitch is great, but then when you stand back from it, it's like, yeah, but it's for like this down market, shitty, not even McDonald's level product, that this is still what has to go into it. And this is what passes for art in this industry. Like, you can appreciate it and then also be like, come on, which I think the show always had that sort of come on attitude at the end of the day of what they were really doing, too. I love this episode, and I did not want to keep watching. I felt like they should have stopped it here, even though we hadn't gotten the real series finale. Maybe John Hamm would not have ever met his beautiful wife, because she was in that episode as well.
Let's make this official. Crystal, what do you say on Waterloo?
Yes, canon worthy.
All right, Tara.
Me too.
Sarah?
Me three.
All right, that makes it a sweep. So... Mad Men, Season 7, Episode 7, Waterloo, you're hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
All right, it's time to discover the winner and loser of the week. Sarah has this week's winner.
I do. It is Tessa Stewart, who's reporting on the Zizian cult. Allegedly, for Rolling Stone, is now being developed as a docuseries at HBO. I think that's the perfect place for that. And for her work, Stewart has a, I don't know, like not first person exactly, but there's a way about the reporting that I think is best served by the gold standard of these HBO having charge of it. So I'm looking forward to that.
And loser of the week.
Well, we talked about Jill Zarin a few months ago when she showed her ass complaining that there weren't any white people in the halftime show at the Super Bowl. And she's back. Now she's getting sued by what else? Her pickleball startup. She partnered with someone who invested $500,000 in this business that was creating some kind of piece of pickleball equipment. I don't know, and I will not find out.
They were pickling the balls.
Anyway, Jill Zarin's says that her, you know, her track record is clean. She's never lost any of the times she's been sued. And I just feel like if you can point to more than one example where that's happened, you're not doing great in life. Worst of luck to Jill Zarin. Go to hell.
Speaking about not doing great in life, do you know what time it is?
Pickleball time?
Game time.
It is game time. Picking up from our last regulation game time in episode 609, this is the eighth of the season. The scores are Tara with 4, still on the cusp of season victory. Sarah won the last one, so she's at 1, and value guests have 2. Today, we're playing TV Popularity Contest 3 from Miles, who earns himself an extra credit topic. Ka-ching. Of his choosing, plus a free shirt at the EHE store at throughmethods.com. Hey. It has been a year and a half since our last edition of this, and to remind you how it is played, the goal of this game is to figure out who is the most popular cast member from a particular show. Not top billed, but the most popular, according to the crazy people at IMDb. That includes polls, how fast they rise up the charts, how many searches there are for them. All that goes into the algorithm for the most popular on IMDb. So, in round one, I am first going to read you, from a particular show, the top billed actors, just to give you a flavor of who's in it, in case you need reminding. And then we will go in turn. You will guess who is the most popular actor, according to IMDb, from that show. If you guess the most popular actor, I'm going to give you 4 points. If you guess the fourth most popular, I'll give you 1. That sort of scoring system. Make sense?
Yes.
All right.
Yep.
There is a round two and a round three. Basic rules are the same, but I'll get into the details when we hit that. Tiebreaker available if needed. No steel mills, no Grossworth Equalizer Challenge Zone. So let's go straight to Piggy to see our order today.
We will start with valued guest.
Okay, so that means you get first guess at who is the most popular. Everybody is going to submit one for every question. All right, here we go. Our first show is Brooklyn Nine-Nine. The top billed actors are Andy Samberg, Stephanie Beatrice, Terry Crews, and Melissa Fumero. Now, Crystal, you have to tell me who is the most popular, and they have to be in 5 or more episodes. So it could be a regular cast member, but it also could be like a reoccurring guest star. And you have to think who is the most popular, and this may, in your thought process, bring you outside of the show. You know, if Keanu Reeves was on Brooklyn Nine-Nine, he might be in the most popular list of Brooklyn Nine-Nine actors.
I see.
All right. So with all that in mind, Crystal, you get first crack at the most popular actor from Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
Oh my gosh, this is really hard. There are two in my head that I'm thinking of. I'm just going to say Andre Brower.
All right, Andre Brower to Tara.
I'm going to say Jason Mantzoukas.
All right, Sarah D. Bunting.
I'm going to go Sandberg.
All right, I'm going to go bottom up, so fourth to first most popular. Fourth, Jason Mantzoukas for 1 point.
Woo!
Good job, Tara.
Third, Kira Sedgwick, 3 points. Nobody guessed that one. Andy Sandberg clocking in at number two. So Sarah D. Bundy gets 3 points. Nobody, number one, Stephanie Beatrice, the most popular actor. Don't forget, last time we played this, you have to count the horn dogs.
Right.
The horn dogs were a big part of some of the listings here. All right, so is on to the next show.
I'm one of the horn dogs that got Andy his placement, so you're welcome, Sarah.
Tara, you'll be guessing first for Girls 5 Eva.
Okay.
We've got Sarah Bareilles.
Mm-hmm.
Busy Phillips, Paula Pell, and Renee Elise Goldsberry.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the top billed, not necessarily the most popular on IMDb. Who do you think is the most popular? Tara.
I'm so torn, but I'm going to say Busy Phillips.
All right, to Sarah.
I mean, this isn't really the horn dog vote, but actually, you know what? Goldsberry.
Goldsberry. All right, and Crystal, who do you think?
I was going to pick Goldsberry. I don't know, Sarah Bareilles, I guess.
All right, here are your rankings. Coming in at number four is Goldsberry, 1 point. Busy Phillips is third for 2 points.
Okay.
Ashley Park is second for 3 points. And Paula Pell, number one, a surprising number one.
Good for her. I love that for her.
I was going to guess Paula, but I was like, is that a horn dog? Is that a horn dog trap? Oh.
I was thinking Dean Winters. He was the other one that I was torn with. So I'm glad I didn't say it because he is not ranked, apparently.
All right, Sarah Bunting, you'll be up first for the next show, which is Girls. Girls, Lena Dunham, Allison Williams, Jemima Kirk, and Adam Driver. But who is the most popular actor from Girls that was in more than five episodes? Five or more episodes.
I am torn because Driver, but also I think Eben Moss Bacharach. I'm going to fuck it. Richie, Eben Moss Bacharach is my guess.
All right, Crystal.
I was going to say Adam Driver.
All right, Tara.
Allison Williams, I guess.
All right, here we go. Coming in at number four. I always forget how to say her name. Zosha Mamet.
Zosha.
Zosha Mamet. Mm-hmm. Coming in at number three for 2 points is Mr. Adam Driver.
Nice.
Second place, Jake Lacy. And number one, Allison Williams, our first bullseye.
Okay.
That is
points
for Tara.
Gosh.
Thank you, horn dogs.
So bad at this. Okay, I got to start thinking like a horn dog.
All right, next show, Crystal, you'll be starting us off. It is News Radio, David Foley, Stephen Root, Andy Dick, My Attorney. Who is the most popular? Could be one of them, could be somebody else.
I'm going to say this name, and I hate saying it, but I'm going to say Joe Rogan.
You got to do it. All right,
unfortunately.
Tara.
Stephen Root.
All right.
Oh,
Stephen Root. Sarah D. Bunting.
Hartman.
All right. Here are your rankings coming in. Number four, Candy Alexander.
Nice.
Job. Coming in third, Patrick Warburton.
Okay.
Coming in second, Stephen Root.
Okay.
And number one, My Attorney.
Really?
My Attorney, More Attorney. All right. Happy Endings is our next show. We're going to start with Tara.
Alicia Cuthbert. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Elza Coop, Alicia Cuthbert, Zachary Knighton, Adam Pally.
Right.
All right. Tara, you're first.
Yeah, I'm going to stick on Alicia Cuthbert.
All right. Sarah.
Wayans.
All right. Crystal.
I was going to say Damon Wayans, too. Adam Pally.
All right, here are your rankings. Number four, Casey Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
Love her.
Number three for 2 points, Damon Wayans Jr.
Nice.
Take it.
Second place for 3 points, Liza Coop. And number one, Alicia Cuthbert.
Four points for Tara.
That was just the luck of the draw.
Yep. All right, here's our last one for round one. We're talking about Star Trek Strange New Worlds. Got Melissa Navia.
Mm-hmm.
Anson Mount, Ethan Peck, Christina Chong. But that's just billing. Who's the most popular according to IMDb? Bum, bum, bum. Sarah D. Bunting, you're starting us off.
I don't. Which direction? Which axis is the right? Horndoggery?
Hair-based searches?
Which is why I'm gonna hope Gen X is staying horny for Rebecca Romijn.
Right. Ugh, shit, that's what I was gonna say.
Crystal, you're next.
I don't know the show at all, so I'm gonna say Anson Mount.
All right. Fuck. Tara?
Good call.
All your picks gone?
Yes. I guess I'll say Paul Wesley, who plays Kirk.
Wesley.
Oh,
Wesley.
Smart.
All right, here we go. Fourth most popular for 1 point, Anson Mount.
Nice. Good job.
Hey.
Third most popular, Carol Kane.
Hmm.
Oh,
second
oh,
most
nice.
Popular, Rebecca Romijn.
Hey.
3 points. Number one, Paul Wesley
Shut
for
up.
4 points.
Nice. Oh my God.
So smart.
And that is Heck. Round one.
Damn, Holy the shit. Vampire Diaries fandom is still out here.
Absolutely getting killed, Crystal.
I don't understand the like, I'm not out of the strategy. I'm bad at it.
All right, let's get the scores, please.
Okay, Crystal has 3. Sarah has 9. I have 18.
All right. Well, the good news is in round 2, all the scores double. So it's good. 8, 6, 4, and 2 points, depending
okay.
on how well you do.
Great.
And you do not get any top-billed actors, so you do not get
oh,
any clues as
okay.
who's on
oh,
the shows.
Right.
But these are all well-known shows. I don't think you'll have too much trouble. So let's get into it. With our first show, Crystal will start us again with Arrested Development, the OG series. So I guess they're listed separately.
Michael Cera.
All right, Michael Cera. Tara.
Jason Bateman.
Sarah.
I think Bateman's the call, but I then will choose
the following.
The following. Actor who is named Portia de Rossi.
All right, here are your listings. Number 4, Ben Stiller.
Mm-hmm.
Number 3, 4 points, Jason Bateman. Coming in at number 2, Charlize Theron.
Oh,
season 3.
Right.
Number 1, Isla Fisher.
Okay.
My wife. So only Jason Bateman scored for you guys.
Gosh.
All right. Tara, start us off.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about Dawson's Creek. Dawson's Creek.
Bitch. I mean, are people searching him more because he... I'm still going to say Joshua Jackson.
All right. I will let you know this game came in towards the end of February, so it's all very recent.
Okay.
The rankings, oh. the popularity choices.
I'm still going to stick on Jackson.
Okay. Sarah D. Bundy.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I'm torn, but I mean, may he rest. May his memory literally be a blessing, Mr. James Vanderbeek.
To you only.
Crystal. Dawson's Creek.
I'm going to say Michelle Williams.
All right. Here are your rankings. Coming in at number 4, Joshua Jackson.
Okay.
Coming in at number 3, Jensen Ackles.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Okay.
Coming in at number 2, Chad Michael Murray.
Fuck.
Coming in at number 1, Sasha Alexander.
What is happening?
Good grief.
Rizzoli? Come on.
CIA's people are crazy.
Yeah, they are. Napoli.
All right. Sarah, you going to start us off? For White Lotus. White Lotus. Who is the most popular IMDb White Lotus actor? Tough one. Lots of, you know, every season's got a new cast almost.
Praying Sarah doesn't remember my pick was on the show.
Patrick Schwarzenegger. Bug it.
All right.
You want horny? I got that.
Crystal.
Jennifer Coolidge.
Guys. Tara. Sydney Sweeney was in season 1.
Oh, she was. Oh, that's right. Yes, Fuck. I just remember.
Here are your rankings. Number 4, you got to go Horn Dog, guys. Number 4, Amy Lee Wood.
Mm-hmm.
Number 3, Walton Goggins.
Sure.
Oh, of course.
Number 2, Haley Lou Richardson.
Uh-huh.
Number 1 with a bullet, Sydney Sweeney.
You're right.
You're 8 so, points.
You got it. I totally forgot about that.
Our next show is The Other Two, starting with Crystal.
Again, I know like 2 actors from this show. So this is not one of my shows.
I'm just going to let y'all know this is the most surprising ranking of the one. I'm just
okay.
like, what?
Huh? Okay. All right. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I'll just guess Molly Shannon then.
All right. Molly Shannon from Crystal. Tara.
I don't know.
Ken Marino?
Sarah.
I think those are the only actor names that I even know.
Well, you can say a character and I'll tell you who played them.
I don't remember his name, but he's also on Running Point.
Oh, Drew Tarver.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Him. Okay, here are your rankings. Coming in at number 4, Brandon Scott Jones.
Mm-hmm.
Coming in at number 3 for 4 points, Ken Marino.
Okay.
Coming in at number 2, would have been worth 6 points, Richard Kind.
Aw, cute.
And coming in at number 1, Josh Segarra.
Oh, of course. God damn it.
Yeah.
I don't know who. All right. Is.
Next show, Hacks. And we're starting with Tara.
Oh, boy. It's a tough one. This is an out of left field pick, but I'm going to stand by it. Christopher McDonald.
All right.
Ow.
You eat pieces of shit for breakfast. Sarah D. Bunting.
I'm blanking on names too now. Well, at least I'm not blanking on her name this game time. Jean Smart, I guess. Don't know
right,
what else to
Jean
do.
Jean Smart. Crystal, what's your pick?
Tony Goldwyn.
All right, here are your rankings. Nice. Number 4 for 2 points, Jean Smart.
Okay.
Number 3 for 4 points, Helen Hunt.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, right.
Number 2, Lauren Weedman.
Oh, I like
awesome.
That.
Yeah.
And number 1, Caitlin Olson.
Yeah, I thought of that after.
Right, so, of course.
Jean Smart, the only scoring actor there.
Good job, Sarah.
Last Thanks. Show of round 2. We're almost done. Here Thank we God. Go. The OG version of Scrubs. The OG version of Scrubs. So everything up to and including the ABC med school season, but not including the reboot.
Okay.
Excuse me. Revival.
Yeah. You're excused. Faisal.
Yeah.
All right. Crystal?
I don't know. The short Zach Braff, I guess.
All right. Zach Braff. Tara?
I don't remember if she was in more than 5 episodes, but Tara Reid?
All right, here we go. Get ready not to mark any points.
Okay.
Yay.
Dave Franco.
Yeah.
I was going to guess it. Oh,
Julie Reyes.
Mm-hmm.
Elizabeth Banks.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Krista Miller, number 1.
I almost
Of course.
Fuck.
Of course.
All right. Oh, that is round 2. Round 3 is short, so we're almost done. Let's get the scores.
Okay, Crystal has 3. Uh-huh. Sarah has 11.
Yep.
I have 36.
Yes, there we go.
Okay. I was going to say, it's anybody's game. There's 16 points on the board here, but I think that's mathematically impossible.
On track.
Oh, my
God. All right,
God.
Round 3. Everybody has 1 crack at it. The points double again, so it's 16, 12, 8, 4.
Shit. Mm-mm. Okay.
The show is American Horror Story, singular, not stories. Crystal, you'll get first crack, then Sarah, then Tara.
Okay.
I mean, Sarah Paulson.
All right. Sarah Paulson. Sarah?
Singular, right?
Yeah, American Horror mm-hmm. Story, not the stories.
Lady Gaga.
Ooh.
Smart. That's a good guess. I don't know why I'm saying her, because no one likes her, but I'm doing it anyway. Emma Roberts.
All right. Here we go. See who could get them big points. Brackets, nobody.
Oh, no!
Yay.
Lily Rabe. Number 4.
Fuck.
Kate Mara, number 3.
Mm-hmm.
Good for them.
Evan Peters, number 2.
I knew it. Him. Yes.
Number 1.
Connie
hands
Britton.
To face. Macaulay Culkin.
Oh,
right.
Come on.
I don't know who's going to show this. Okay,
all right,
great.
The scores are the same, but let's hear them one more time.
Okay. Crystal, finish with 3. Sarah, 11. Me, 36.
All right, nicely done.
If you stack
done.
3 me and Crystals in a trench coat, we still don't have as many points as Tara.
Ugh. Let's play the tiebreaker well for shits and giggles.
Okay.
There are 29 names that qualify for this show. It is The Simpsons.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're going to do is we're going to give everybody 2 actor guesses, and we're going to see who guessed first. So we'll go around the horn. We'll go, Crystal, who is your first guess? For The Simpsons, most popular Simpsons voice actor.
Do they don't have to have been in 5 episodes, or do they?
Yes, they have to have been in 5 okay. episodes.
I want to say Albert Brooks.
Albert Brooks. All right. Who is your first guest, Tara?
Kelsey Grammer.
Kelsey Grammer. Yeah. All right. Sarah D. Bunting.
Hartman.
Hartman. All right. Back to Crystal. Second choice.
I'm so bad at this. I don't know what people would be searching. I'm only thinking of like main cast now. I don't know. Dan Castellaneta.
Tara, last pick.
Joe Mantegna.
And Sarah, your last pick.
Zaria.
Yeah, that's a good guess.
Hank Azaria.
All right, here we go. I'm going to read your choices bottom up. He was last in the popularity polls, but first in our hearts is Phil Hartman.
Ah, glad he was ranked.
Next up the ladder, Dan Castellaneta, followed by Joe Mantegna.
Mantegna?
Yes, that guy. Mm-hmm. Joe M.
Yep.
Kelsey Grammer, one below Albert Brooks.
Oh.
But Hank Azaria was the fourth most popular voice actor on The Simpsons, according to IMDb. Above him, Kerry Washington,
okay.
Glenn Close.
Sure.
J.K. Simmons, number one.
Oh, all right.
Wow.
All right, nicely done, Sarah. But Tara wins the game.
Yeah, she does.
Very handily.
Yes.
Tara.
And good that job, also Tara. Wraps up the season. History repeats itself. Try and you succeed. Yes. Yes. Around. Nothing around. I'll keep you down. Yes. Around.
What are you doing?
I just put my fingers in my mouth and sing.
All right.
Congrats, Tara. All we'll right. Play.
Thanks.
Guys, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We traveled back to Netflix for season two of Running Point. See, I know one basketball thing is called traveling. Before going around the dial with stops at Call the Midwife, Jerry West, the logo. Killing Grounds, Julie sold us her pitch for Mad Men's Burger Chef Pitch episode Waterloo. We crowned winners and losers of the week. And Tara was the winner of this week's Game Time from Miles. Next up on EEHG this Friday, we're going to be talking about Widow's Bay. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Arianna.
Marriage is a racket.
Sarah D. Bunting.
She's never worn lipstick to the pool before.
And Crystal Farmer.
Shut up, Harry.
Thanks for listening. And we'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Grit.
Got a couple businesses I'm trying to get off the ground, but right now what's keeping the lights on is the RV repo. It's a tough business. Like last week, I'm hauling away this beautiful 2022 Dream Rider. We're going from Henderson to Tahoe. Halfway along the way, I hear like a bang, and I'm like, fuck, I got a flat. So I pull over, I go in there. It was the owner. He blew his brains out right around Zizix.
Jesus. Oh.
Happy ending. Police said he was a pedophile. Justice. Boom.
Wow. Oh, boy.